Dear Durnick, she said again, I cannot even allow myself such thoughts. Why, you forget who I am.
Well, that's not very likely. You're usually very careful to keep the fact firmly in front of everybody.
Well, don't you know what it means?
He looked a bit perplexed.
I don't quite follow.
I'm an imperial princess, the jewel of the empire, and I belong to the empire. I'll have absolutely no voice in the decision about who I am going to marry. That decision will be made by my father and the council of advisors. My husband will be rich and powerful, probably much older than I am. And my marriage to him will be to the advantage of the empire and the House of Borun. I probably won't even be consulted in the matter.
Durnick looked stunned. Well, that's outrageous.
Not really. My family has the right to protect its interests, and I'm an extremely valuable asset to the Boruns.
She sighed again, a forlorn little sigh.
Oh, it might be nice, though, to be able to choose for myself. I mean, if I could, I might even look at Gary in the way you seem to think I have been looking. Even though he's absolutely impossible. The way things are, though, all he can ever be is a friend.
I didn't know,
he apologized, his plain, practical face melancholy.
Oh, don't take it so seriously, Durnick,
she said lightly.
I have always known that this was the way things have to be.
A large, glistening tear, however, welled into the corner of her eye, and Durnick awkwardly put his work-worn hand on her arm to comfort her. Without knowing why, she threw her arms around his neck, buried her face in his chest, and sobbed.
"Oh, now, there, there," he said, clumsily patting her shaking shoulder. "There, there."
Chapter 3 Garion did not sleep well that night. Although he was young and inexperienced, he was not stupid, and Princess Tenedra had been fairly obvious. Over the months since she had joined them, he had seen her attitude toward him change until they had shared a rather specialized kind of friendship. He liked her. She liked him. Everything had been fine up to that point. Why couldn't she just leave it alone? Garion surmised that it probably had something to do with the inner workings of the female mind. As soon as a friendship passed a certain point, some obscure and secret boundary, a woman quite automatically became overwhelmed by a raging compulsion to complicate things. He was almost certain that her transparent little game with Mandorallan had been aimed at him, and he wondered if it might not be a good idea to warn the knight to spare him more heartbreak in the future. Tenedra's toying with the great man's affections was little more than the senseless cruelty of a spoiled child. Mandorallan must be warned. His horrendous thick-headedness might easily cause him to overlook the obvious. And yet, Mandorallan had killed the lion for her. Such stupendous bravery could quite easily have overwhelmed the flighty little princess. What if her admiration and gratitude had pushed her over the line into infatuation? That possibility, coming to Garion as it did in those darkest hours just before dawn, banished all possibility of further sleep. He arose the next morning, sandy-eyed and surly, and with a terrible worry gnawing at him. As they rode out through the blue-tinged shadows of early morning, with the slanting rays of the newly risen sun gleaming on the treetops above them, Garion fell in beside his grandfather, seeking the comfort of the old man's companionship. It was not only that, however. Tenedra was riding demurely with Aunt Paul just ahead, and Garion felt very strongly that he should keep an eye on her. Mr. Wolfe rode in silence, looking cross and irritable, and he frequently dug his fingers under the splint on his left arm. "Leave it alone, father," Aunt Paul told him without turning around.
"It itches."
"That's because it's healing. Now just leave it alone."
He grumbled about that under his breath.
"Which route are you planning to take to the Vale?"
We'll go around by way of Tol Rain.
The season is moving on, Father. If we take too long, she reminded him, we will run into bad weather in the mountains.
I know that, Paul. Would you rather cut straight across Maragor?
Don't be absurd. Is Maragor really all that dangerous?
Geryon asked. Princess Synaedra turned in her saddle and gave him a withering look.
Don't you know anything?
She asked him with towering superiority. Geryon drew himself up, a dozen suitable responses to that coming to mind almost at once. Mr. Wolf shook his head warningly.
Just let it pass. It's much too early to start in on that just now.
Geryon clenched his teeth together. They rode for an hour or more through the cool morning, and Geryon gradually felt his temper improving. Then Hetar rode up to speak with Mr. Wolf.
There are some riders coming, he reported.
How many?
12 or more. Coming in from the west.
Well, they could be Tonedrans.
I'll see,
Aunt Paul murmured. She lifted her face and closed her eyes for a moment.
No, not Tonedrans. Murgos.
Hetar's eyes went flat.
Do we fight?
He asked with a dreadful kind of eagerness, his hand going to his saber.
No, Wolf replied curtly. We hide.
There aren't really that many of them.
Never mind, Hetar,
Wolf told him.
Selk, he called ahead. There are some Murgos coming toward us from the west. Warn the others. Find us all a place to hide.
Silk nodded curtly and galloped forward.
Are there any Grolems with them?
The old man asked Aunt Paul.
I don't think so, she answered, with a small frown. One of them has a strange mind, but he doesn't seem to be a Grolem.
Silk rode back quickly.
There's a thicket off to the right. It is big enough to hide in.
Let's go, then.
The thicket was 50 yards back among the larger trees. It appeared to be a patch of dense brush surrounding a small hollow. The ground in the hollow was marshy, and there was a spring at its center. Silk had swung down from his horse and was hacking a thick bush off close to the ground with his short sword.
Take cover in here. I'll go back and brush out our tracks.
He picked up the bush and wormed his way out of the thicket.
Be sure that the horses do not make any noise,
Wolf told Hetar. Hetar nodded, but his eyes showed his disappointment. Geryon dropped to his knees and wormed his way through the thick brush until he reached the edge of the thicket. Then he sank down on the leaves, covering the ground to peer out between the gnarled, stumpy trunks. Silk, walking backward and swinging his bush, was sweeping leaves and twigs from the forest floor over the tracks they had made from the trail to the thicket. He was moving quickly, but was careful to obliterate their trail completely. From behind him, Geryon heard a faint snap and a rustle in the leaves, and Synaedra crawled up and sank to the ground at his side.
You shouldn't be this close to the edge of the brush, he told her in a low voice.
Neither should you,
she retorted. He let it pass.
The princess had a warm, flower-like smell. For some reason, it made Geryon very nervous.
How far away do you think they are?
Well, how would I know?
You are a sorcerer, aren't you?
I'm not that good at it.
Silk finished brushing away the tracks and stood for a moment studying the ground as he looked for any trace of their passage that he might have missed. Then he burrowed his way into the thicket and crouched down a few yards from Geryon and Synaedra.
Lord Hetar wanted to fight them,
Synaedra whispered to Geryon. Hetar always wants to fight when he sees Murgos.
Why?
The Murgos killed his parents when he was very young. He had to watch while they did it.
She gasped.
How awful!
If you children don't mind, Silk said sarcastically, I'm trying to listen for horses.
Somewhere beyond the trail they had just left, Geryon heard the thudding sound of horses' hooves moving at a trot. He sank down deeper into the leaves and watched, scarcely breathing.
When the Murgos appeared, there were about 15 of them, mail-shirted and with the scarred cheeks of their race. Their leader, however, was a man in a patched and dirty tunic with coarse black hair. He was unshaven, and one of his eyes was out of line with its fellow. Geryon knew him. Silk drew in a sharp breath with an audible hiss.
"Bryl,"
he muttered.
"Who is Bryl?"
Synedra whispered to Geryon.
"I'll tell you later," he whispered back. "Shush now."
"Don't you shush me,"
she flared. A stern look from Silk silenced them both. Bryl was talking sharply to the Murgos, gesturing with short, jerky movements. Then he raised his hands with his fingers widespread and stabbed them forward to emphasize what he was saying. The Murgos all nodded, their faces expressionless, and spread out along the trail, facing the woods and the thicket where Geryon and the others were hiding. Bryl moved farther up the trail.
"Keep your eyes open,"
he shouted to them.
"Let's go."
The Murgos started to move forward at a walk, their eyes searching. Two of them rode past the thicket so close that Geryon could smell the sweat on their horses' flanks.
"I am getting tired of that man,"
one of them remarked to the other.
"I would not let it show,"
the second one advised.
"I can take orders as well as any man," the first one said. "But that one is beginning to irritate me. I think that he would look better with a knife between his shoulder blades."
"I don't think he'd like that much, and it might be a little hard to manage.
I could wait until he was asleep.
I have never seen him sleep.
Everybody sleeps, sooner or later."
"It's up to you,"
the second replied with a shrug.
"But I would not try anything so rash. Unless you have given up the idea of ever seeing Rehaga again."
The two of them moved on out of earshot. Silk crouched, gnawing nervously at a fingernail. His eyes had narrowed to slits, and his sharp little face was intent. Then he began to swear under his breath.
"What's wrong, Silk?"
Geryon whispered to him.
"I've made a mistake," Silk answered irritably. "Let's go back to the others."
He turned and crawled through the bushes toward the spring at the center of the thicket. Mr. Wolf was seated on a log, scratching absently at his splinted arm.
"Well?"
he asked, looking up. 15 Murgos," Silk replied shortly.
"And an old friend."
"It was Bryl,"
Geryon reported.
"He seemed to be in charge."
"Bryl?"
The old man's eyes widened with surprise.
"He was giving orders, and the Murgos were following them. Oh, they didn't like it much, but they were doing what he told them to do. They seemed to be afraid of him. I think Bryl is something more than an ordinary hireling."
"Where is Rehaga?"
Synedra asked. Wolf looked at her sharply.
"We heard two of them talking. They said they were from Rehaga. I thought I knew the names of all of the cities in Sol Murgos, but I've never heard of that one."
They said Rehaga?"
Wolf asked her, his eyes intent.
"I heard them too," Geryon told him. "That was the name they used. Rehaga."
Mr. Wolf stood up, his eyes suddenly grim.
"We're going to have to hurry then. Tar Urgas is preparing for war."
"How do you know that?"
Beric asked him.
"Rehaga's 1,000 leagues south of Rakgoska, and the southern Murgos are never brought up into this part of the world unless the Murgo king is on the verge of going to war with someone."
"Let them come,"
Beric said with a bleak smile.
"If it is all the same to you, I'd like to get our business attended to first. I have got to go to Raxol, and I'd prefer not to have to wade through whole armies of Murgos to get there."
The old man shook his head angrily.
"What is Tower Urgas thinking of? It's not time yet."
Barak shrugged.
"One time is as good as another."
"Not for this war.
Too many things have to happen first. Can't Tuchik keep a leash on that maniac?
Unpredictability is part of Char Urgo's unique charm, Silk observed sardonically. He doesn't know himself what he's going to do from one day to the next.
Knowest thou the king of the Murgos? Mandarallan inquired.
We've met, Silk replied. We are not fond of each other.
Brill and his Murgo should be gone by now, Mr. Wolf said. Let's move on. We've got a long way to go, and time is starting to catch up with us.
He moved quickly toward his horse. Shortly before sundown, they went through a high pass lying in a notch between two mountains and stopped for the night in a little glen a few miles down on the far side.
Keep the fire down as much as you can, Dennick, Mr. Wolf warned the smith. Southern Murgos have sharp eyes, and they can see the light from a fire from miles away. I'd rather not have company in the middle of the night.
Dennick nodded soberly and dug his fire pit somewhat deeper than usual. Mandarallan was attentive to the Princess Sinedra as they set up for the night, and Geryon watched sourly. Though he had violently objected each time Aunt Paul had insisted that he serve as Sinedra's personal attendant, now that the tiny girl had her knight to fetch and carry for her, Geryon felt somehow that his rightful position had in some way been usurped.
"We're going to have to pick up our pace,"
Wolf told them, after they had finished a meal of bacon, bread, and cheese.
"We've got to get through these mountains before the first storms hit, and we are going to have to try to stay ahead of Brill and his Murgos."
He scraped a space clear on the ground in front of him with a foot, picked up a stick, and began sketching a map in the dirt.
"We are here," he pointed. "Maragor's directly ahead of us. We will circle to the west, go through Tolrain, and then strike northeast toward the Vale. Might it not be shorter to cross Maragor?" Mandarallan suggested, pointing at the crude map. "Perhaps," the old man replied. "But we won't do that unless we have to. Maragor's haunted, and it is best to avoid it if possible." "We are not children to be frightened of insubstantial shades," Mandarallan declared somewhat stiffly.
"No one is doubting your courage, Mandarallan, but the spirit of Mara wails in Maragor," Aunt Paul told him. "It is better not to offend him."
"How far is it to this Vale of Alder?" Dernick asked. 250 leagues, Wolf answered. "We will be a month or more in the mountains, even under the best of conditions. Now we had better all get some sleep. Tomorrow is likely to be a very hard day."
Chapter 4 When they rose the next morning, as the first pale hint of light was appearing on the eastern horizon, there was a touch of silvery frost on the ground, and a thin scum of ice around the edges of the spring at the bottom of the glen. Sinedra, who had gone to the spring to wash her face, lifted a thin shard from the water and stared at it.
"Oh, it's much colder up in these mountains,"
Geryon told her as he belted on his sword.
"I am aware of that,"
she replied loftily.
"Forget it,"
he said shortly, and stomped away, muttering. They rode down out of the mountains in the bright morning sunlight, moving at a steady trot. As they rounded a shoulder of outcropping rock, they saw the broad basin that had once been Maragor, the district of the Marags, stretching out below them. The meadows were a dusty autumn green, and the streams and lakes sparkled in the sun. A tumbled ruin, looking tiny in the distance, gleamed far out on the plain. Princess Sinedra, Geryon noticed, kept her eyes averted, refusing even to look. Not far down the slope below them, a cluster of crude huts and lopsided tents lay in a steep gully where a frothy creek had cut down through the rocks and gravel. Dirt streets and paths wandered crookedly up and down the sides of the gully, and a dozen or so ragged-looking men were hacking somewhat dispiritedly at the creek bank with picks and mattocks, turning the water below the shabby settlement a muddy yellow-brown.
"There's a town,"
Dunnick questioned.
Out here?
Not exactly a town, Worf replied. The men in those settlements sift gravel and dig up the stream banks, looking for gold.
Is there gold here? Silk asked quickly, his eyes bright.
A little, Worf said. Probably not enough to make it worth anyone's time to look for it.
Well, why do they bother, then?
Worf shrugged. Who knows?
Mundrellan and Barak took the lead, and they moved down the rocky trail toward the settlement. As they approached, two men came out of one of the huts with rusty swords in their hands. One, a thin, unshaven man with a high forehead, wore a greasy Tolnedrin jerkin. The other, much taller and bulkier, was dressed in the ragged tunic of an Arendish serf.
"That is fair enough," the Tolnedrin shouted.
"We don't like armed men coming in here until we know what their business is."
Barak advised him, "You're blocking the trail, friend. You might find that unhealthy."
"One shout from me will bring 50 armed men," the Tolnedrin warned.
"Don't be an idiot, Realdor," the big errand told him. "That one with all the steel on him is a membrane knight. There aren't enough men on the whole mountain to stop him if he decides to go here."
He looked warily at Mandorallan.
"What are your intentions, Sir Knight?" he asked respectfully.
"We are but following the trail," Mandorallan replied. "We have no interest in thy community."
Beren grunted. "That's good enough for me. Let them pass, Reldo."
He slid his sword back under his rope belt.
"What if he is lying?" Reldo retorted. "What if they are here to steal our gold?"
"What gold, you jackass?" the Arend demanded with contempt. "There isn't enough gold in this whole camp to fill a thimble, and membrane knights don't lie. If you want to fight with him, go ahead. After it's over, we will scoop up what's left of you and dump you in a hole someplace."
"You have got a bad mouth, Bereg,"
Reldo observed darkly.
"And what do you plan to do about it?"
The Tolnedrin glared at the larger man and then turned and walked away, muttering curses. Bereg laughed harshly, then turned back to Mandorallan.
"Come ahead, Sir Knight. Reldo's all mouth. You don't have to worry about him."
Mandorallan moved forward at a walk.
"Thou art a long way from home, my friend,"
Bereg shrugged. "There wasn't anything on Orendia to keep me. And I had a misunderstanding with my lord over a pig. When he started talking about hanging, I thought I'd like to try my luck in a different country."
"Seems like a sensible decision," Barak laughed.
Barak winked at him.
"The trail goes right on down to the creek, then up the other side behind those shacks. The men over there are Nadraks, but the only one who might give you any trouble is Tylek. He got drunk last night, though, so he's probably still sleeping it off."
A vacant-eyed man in Sindarian clothing shambled out of one of the tents. Suddenly he lifted his face and howled like a dog. Bereg picked up a rock and shied it at him. The Sindar dodged the rock and ran yelping behind one of the shacks.
"One of these days, I'm going to do him a favor and stick a knife in him," Bereg remarked sourly. "You know he bays at the moon all night long."
"What is his problem?"
Bereg asked. Bereg shrugged.
"Crazy. He thought he could make a dash into Maragor and pick up some gold before the ghosts caught him. He was wrong."
"Oh, what did they do to him?"
Dernick asked, his eyes wide.
"Nobody knows. Every so often, somebody gets drunk or greedy and thinks he can get away with it. It wouldn't do you any good. Even if the ghost didn't catch you, anybody coming out is stripped immediately by his friends. Nobody gets to keep any gold he brings out, so why bother?"
"Oh, you've got such a charming society here," Silk observed wryly.
Bereg laughed. "It suits me. Better than decorating a tree in my lord's apple orchard back in Orendia."
He scratched absently at his armpit. I guess I had better go do some digging. Good luck. He turned and started toward one of the tents.
Let's move along, Wolf said quietly. These places tend to get rowdy as the days wear on.
You seem to know quite a bit about them, Father, Aunt Paul noticed.
They're good places to hide, he replied. Nobody asks any questions. I have needed to hide a time or two in my life.
I wonder why.
They started along the dusty street between the slapped-together shacks and patched tents, moving down toward the rolling creek.
Wait!
Somebody called from behind. A scruffy-looking Drasnian was running after them, waving a small leather pouch. He caught up with them, puffing.
Why, didn't you wait?
He demanded.
And what do you want? Silk asked him.
I will give you 50 pennyweight of fine gold for the girl,
the Drasnian panted, waving his leather sack again. Mandarallan's face went black, and his hand moved toward his sword hilt.
Why don't you let me deal with this, Mandarallan? Silk suggested mildly, swinging down from his saddle.
Tenedra's expression had first registered shock, then outrage. She appeared almost on the verge of explosion before Geryon reached her and put his hand on her arm.
Watch,
he told her softly.
How dare...
Hush.
Just watch. Silk's going to take care of it.
That's a pretty paltry offer, Silk said, his fingers flicking idly. She's still young, the other Drasnian signaled back. She obviously hasn't had much training yet. Which of you owns her?
We'll get to that in a moment, Silk replied. Surely you can make a better offer than that.
It's all I've got, the scruffy man answered plaintively, waving his fingers. And I don't want to go into partnership with any of the brigands in this place. I'd never get to see any of the prophets.
Silk shook his head.
I'm sorry. It's out of the question, he refused.
I'm sure you can see our position.
Tenedra was making strangled noises.
Be quiet,
Geryon snapped.
This isn't what it seems to be.
What about the older one?
The scruffy man suggested, sounding desperate.
Surely 50 pennyweight's a good price for her.
Without warning, Silk's fist lashed out and the scruffy Drasnian reeled back from the apparent blow. His hand flew to his mouth and he began to spew curses.
Run him off, Mandarallan. Silk said quite casually.
The grim-faced knight drew his broadsword and moved his warhorse deliberately at the swearing Drasnian. After one startled yelp, the man turned and fled.
What did he say?
Wolf asked Silk.
You were standing in front of him. I couldn't see.
The whole region is alive with Murgos, Silk replied, climbing back on his horse. Charon says that a dozen parties of them have been through here in the last week.
You knew that animal?
Tenedra demanded.
Charon? Oh, of course. We went to school together.
Drasnians like to keep an eye on things, Princess, Wolf told her. King Rhodar has agents everywhere.
That awful man is an agent of King Rhodar?
Tenedra asked incredulously. Silk nodded.
Actually, Kerenza Margrave, he has exquisite manners under normal circumstances. He asked me to convey his compliments.
Tenedra looked baffled.
Drasnians talk to each other with their fingers,
Geryon explained.
I thought everybody knew that.
Tenedra's eyes narrowed at him.
What Kerenza actually said was, tell the red-haired wench that I apologize for the insult,
Geryon informed her smugly.
He needed to talk to Silk, and he had to have an excuse.
Wench?
His word, not mine,
Geryon replied quickly.
You know this sign language?
Naturally.
That will do, Geryon, Aunt Paul said firmly.
Charon recommends that we get out of here immediately,
Silk told Mr. Wolf.
He says that the Murgos are looking for somebody. Us, probably.
From the far side of the camp, there were sudden angry voices. Several dozen Nedraks boiled out of their shanties to confront a group of Murgor horsemen who had just ridden up out of a deep gully. At the forefront of the Nedrax hulked a huge, fat man who looked more animal than human. In his right hand he carried a brutal-looking steel mace.
"Kardog," he bellowed. "I told you I'd kill you next time you came here."
The man who stepped out from among the Murgor horses to face the hulking Nedrax was Brill.
"You've told me a lot of things, Tarlak," he shouted back. "This time, you get what's coming to you, Kardog,"
Turlok roared, striding forward and swinging his mace.
"Stay back," Brill warned, stepping away from the horses. "I don't have time for this right now." "You don't have time left at all, Kardog, for anything."
Merak was grinning broadly. "Would anyone like to take this opportunity to say goodbye to a friend over there? I think he's about to leave on a very long journey."
But Brill's right hand had dipped suddenly inside his tunic. With a flickering movement, he whipped out a peculiar-looking triangular steel object about 6 inches across. Then, in the same movement, he flipped it, spinning and whistling, directly at Tarlak. The flat steel triangle sailed, flashing in the sun as it spun, and it disappeared with a sickening sound of shearing bone into the hulking Nedrak chest. Silk hissed with amazement. Tarlak stared stupidly at Brill, his mouth agape and his left hand going to the spurting hole in his chest. Then his mace slid out of his right hand, his knees buckled, and he fell heavily forward.
"Let's get out of here," Mr. Wolf barked. "Down the creek. Go!"
They plowed into the rocky stream bed at a plunging gallop, and the muddy water sprayed out from under their horses' hooves. After several hundred yards, they turned sharply to scramble up a steep gravel bank.
"That way,"
Barak shouted, pointing toward more level ground. Geryon did not have time to think, only to cling to his horse and try to keep up with the others. Faintly, far behind, he could hear shouts. They rode behind a low hill and reined in for a moment at Wolf's signal.
"Hittar,"
the old man said.
"See if they're coming."
Hittar wheeled his horse and loped up to a stand of trees on the brow of the hill. Silk was muttering curses, his face livid.
"What's your problem now?"
Barak demanded. Silk kept on swearing.
"What's got him so worked up?"
Barak asked Mr. Wolf.
"Our friend has just had a nasty shock,"
the old man answered.
"He misjudged someone. So did I. That weapon Brill used on the big Nedrak is called an adder sting."
Barak shrugged.
"It looked like just an odd-shaped throwing knife to me." "There's a bit more to it than that. It's as sharp as a razor on all three sides. The points are usually dipped in poison. It is the special weapon of the Dagashi. That's what has got Silk so upset."
"I should have known," Silk berated himself. "Brill's been a little too good all along to just be an ordinary Sindarian footpad."
"Do you know what they're talking about, Bolgara?"
"The Dagashi are a secret society in Kdor Murgos. They are trained killers, assassins. They answer only to Tuchik and their own elders. Tuchik's been using them for centuries to eliminate people who get in his way. They are very efficient."
"I've never been that curious about the peculiarities of Murgo culture. If they want to creep around and kill each other, so much the better."
He glanced up the hill quickly to find out if Hettar had seen anything behind them.
"That thing Brill used might be an interesting toy, but it is no match for armor and a good sword."
"Don't be so provincial, Barak," Silk said, beginning to regain his composure. "A well-thrown adder sting can cut right through a male shirt. If you know how, you can even sail it around corners. Not only that, a Dagashi can kill you with his hands and feet, whether you are wearing armor or not." He frowned. "You know, Belgarath," he mused, "we might have been making a mistake all along. We assumed that Asherak was using Brill. But it might have been the other way around. Brill has to be good, or Ktuchik would not have sent him to the west to keep an eye on us. He smiled then, a chillingly bleak little smile. I wonder just how good he is. He flexed his fingers. I have met a few Dageshi, but never one of their best. That might be very interesting.
Let's not get sidetracked, Wolf told him. The old man's face was grim. He looked at Aunt Paul, and something seemed to pass between them.
You're not serious.
I don't think we've got much choice, Paul. There are Murgos all around us. Too many, and too close. I don't have any room to move. They have got us pinned right up against the southern edge of Maragor. Sooner or later, we are going to get pushed out into the plain anyway. At least, if we make the decision ourselves, we will be able to take some precautions.
I don't like it, Father.
I don't much care for it myself. But we have got to shake off all of these Murgos, or we will never make it to the Vale before winter sets in.
Hetar rode back down the hill.
They are coming, he reported quietly. And there's another group of them circling in from the west to cut us off.
Wolf drew in a deep breath.
I think that pretty well decides it, Paul. Let's go.
As they passed into the belt of trees dotting the last low line of hills bordering the plain, Geryon glanced back once. A half-dozen dust clouds spotted the face of the miles-wide slope above them. Murgos were converging on them from all over the mountains. They galloped on into the trees. Then thundered across the shallow draw. Barak, riding in the lead, suddenly held up his hand.
Men ahead of us.
Murgos?
Hethar asked, his hand going to his saber.
I don't think so. The one I saw looked more like some of those we saw back at the settlement.
Silk, his eyes very bright, pushed his way to the front.
I've got an idea. Let me talk to them.
He pushed his horse into a dead run, plunging directly into what seemed to be an ambush.
Comrades, he shouted, get ready. They are coming. And they've got the gold.
Several shabby-looking men with rusty swords and axes rose from the bushes or stepped out from behind the trees to surround the little man. Silk was talking very fast, gesticulating, waving his arms and pointing back toward the looming behind them.
What is he doing?
Barak asked.
Something devious, I imagine, Wolf replied.
The men surrounding Silk looked dubious at first, but their expressions gradually changed as he continued to talk excitedly. Finally, he turned in his saddle to look back. He jerked his arm in a broad overhead sweep.
Let's go! He shouted.
They're with us.
He spun his horse to scramble up the graveled side of the gully.
Don't get separated,
Barak warned, shifting his shoulders under his mail shirt.
I'm not sure what he's up to, but these schemes of his sometimes fall apart.
They pounded down through the grim-looking brigands and up the side of the gully on Silk's heels.
What did you say to them?
Barak shouted as they rode.
I told them that 15 Murgos had made a dash into Maragor and come out with 3 heavy packs of gold.
Then the little man laughed.
And then I said that the men at the settlement had turned them back and that they were trying to double around this way with the gold. I told them that we'd cover the next gully if they would cover that one back there.
These scoundrels will swarm all over Brill and his Murgos when they try to come through,
Barak suggested.
Oh, I know, Silk laughed. Terrible, isn't it?
They rode on at a gallop. After about half a mile, Mr. Wolf raised his arm, and they all reined in.
This should be far enough. Now listen very carefully, all of you. These hills are alive with Murgos, so we are going to have to go into Maragor.
Princess Sinedra gasped, and her face turned deathly pale.
It will be all right, dear, Aunt Paul soothed her.
Wolf's face was grimly serious.
As soon as we ride out into the plain, you're going to start hearing certain things. Don't pay any attention. Just keep riding. I'm going to be in the lead, and I want you all to watch me very closely. As soon as I raise my hand,
I want you to stop. Get down off your horses immediately. Keep your eyes on the ground and do not look up, no matter what you hear. There are things out there that you don't want to see. Pulgara and I are going to put you all into a kind of sleep. Don't try to fight us. Just relax. Do exactly what we tell you to do.
Sleep? Mandarallan protested. What if we are attacked? How may we defend ourselves if we are asleep?
There isn't anything alive out there to attack you, Mandarallan. And it is not your body that needs to be protected. It's your mind.
What about the horses?
Hetar asked. The horses will be all right. They won't even see the ghosts.
I cannot do it,
Tenedra declared, her voice hovering on the edge of hysteria.
I cannot go into Maragor.
Yes, you can, dear, Aunt Paul told her in that same calm, soothing voice. Stay close to me. I won't let anything happen to you.
Geryon felt a sudden profound sympathy for the frightened little girl, and he drew his horse over beside hers.
I'll be here too, he told her.
She looked at him gratefully, but her lower lip still trembled, and her face was very pale. Mr. Wolf took a deep breath and glanced once at the long slope behind them. The dust clouds raised by the converging Murgles were much closer now.
All right. Let's go.
He turned his horse and began to ride at an easy trot down toward the mouth of the gully and the plain stretching out before them. The sound, at first, seemed faint and very far away, almost like the murmur of wind among the branches of a forest or the soft babbling of water over stones. Then, as they rode farther out onto the plain, it grew louder, more distinct. Geryon glanced back once, almost longingly at the hills behind them. Then he pulled his horse close in beside Zenedra's and locked his eyes on Mr. Wolf's back, trying to close his ears. The sound was now a chorus of moaning cries, punctuated by occasional shrieks. Behind it all, and seeming to carry and sustain all of the other sounds, was a dreadful wailing. A single voice, surely, but so vast and all-encompassing that it seemed to reverberate inside Geryon's head, erasing all thought. Mr. Wolf suddenly raised his hand, and Geryon slid out of his saddle, his eyes fixed almost desperately on the ground. Something flickered at the edge of his vision, but he refused to look. Then Aunt Paul was speaking to them, her voice calm, reassuring.
I want you to form a circle. Take each other's hands. Nothing will be able to enter the circle, so you will be safe.
Trembling in spite of himself, Geryon stretched out his hands. Someone took his left, he did not know who, but he instantly knew that the tiny hand that clung so desperately to his right was Zenedra's. Aunt Paul stood in the center of their circle, and Geryon could feel the force of her presence there washing over all of them. Somewhere outside the circle he could feel Wolf. The old man was doing something that swirled faint surges through Geryon's veins and set off staccato bursts of the familiar roaring sound. The wailing of the dreadful single voice grew louder, more intense, and Geryon felt the first touches of panic. It was not going to work. They were all going to go mad.
Hush now,
Aunt Paul's voice came to him, and he knew that she spoke inside his mind. His panic faded, and he felt a strange, peaceful lassitude. His eyes grew heavy, and the sound of the wailing grew fainter. Then, enfolded in a comforting warmth, he fell almost at once into a profound slumber. Chapter 5 Geryon was not exactly sure when it was that his mind shook off Aunt Paul's soft compulsion to sink deeper and deeper into protective unawareness. It could not have been long, falteringly, like someone rising slowly from the depths. He swam back up out of sleep to find himself moving stiffly, even woodenly, toward the horses with the others. When he glanced at them, he saw that their faces were blank, uncomprehending.
He seemed to hear Aunt Paul's whispered command to sleep, sleep, sleep. But it somehow lacked the power necessary to compel him to obey. There was, to his consciousness, however, a subtle difference. Although his mind was awake, his emotions seemed not to be. He found himself looking at things with a calm, lucid detachment. Uncluttered by those feelings which so often churned his thoughts into turmoil. He knew that in all probability he should tell Aunt Paul that he was not asleep, but for some obscure reason he chose not to. Patiently, he began to sort through the notions and ideas surrounding that decision, trying to isolate the single thought which he knew must lie behind the choice not to speak. In his search, he touched that quiet corner where the other mind stayed. He could almost sense its sardonic amusement.
"Well?"
he said silently to it.
"I see that you're finally awake,"
the other mind said to him.
"No,"
Geryon corrected rather meticulously.
"Actually, a part of me is asleep, I think." That was the part that kept getting in the way.
"We can talk now. We have some things to discuss."
"Who are you?"
Geryon asked, absently following Aunt Paul's instructions to get back on his horse.
"I don't actually have a name."
"You're separate from me, though, aren't you? I mean, you're not just another part of me, are you?"
"No,"
the voice replied.
"We are quite separate."
The horses were moving at a walk now, following Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolf across the meadow.
"What do you want?"
Geryon asked.
"I need to make things come out the way they are supposed to. I've been doing that for a long time now."
Geryon considered that. Around him, the wailing grew louder, and the chorus of moans and shrieks became more distinct. Filmy, half-formed tatters of shape began to appear, floating across the grass toward the horses.
"I'm going to go mad, aren't I?"
he asked somewhat regretfully.
"I'm not asleep like the others are. The ghosts will drive me mad, won't they?"
"Oh, I doubt it," the voice answered. "You will see some things you'd probably rather not see, but I don't think it will destroy your mind. You might even learn some things about yourself that will be useful later on."
"You're very old, aren't you?"
Geryon asked as the thought occurred to him.
"That term doesn't have any meaning in my case." "Older than my grandfather?"
"I knew him when he was a child." "It might make you feel better to know that he was even more stubborn than you are. Oh, it took me a very long time to get him started in the direction he was supposed to go."
"Did you do it from inside his mind?"
"Naturally." Geryon noted that his horse was walking obliviously through one of the filmy images that was taking shape in front of him.
"Then he knows you, doesn't he? If you were in his mind, I mean."
"He didn't know I was there."
"I've always known you were there."
"You're different. That's what we need to talk about." Rather suddenly, a woman's head appeared in the air directly in front of Geryon's face. The eyes were bulging. The mouth was agape in a soundless scream. The ragged, hacked-off stump of its neck streamed blood that seemed to dribble off into nowhere.
"Kiss me,"
it croaked at him. Geryon closed his eyes as his face passed through the head. "You see," the voice pointed out conversationally, "it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be."
"In what way am I different?"
Geryon wanted to know. "Something needs to be done. And you are the one who's going to do it. All of the others have just been in preparation for you."
"What is it exactly that I have to do?"
"You'll know when the time comes. If you find out too soon, it might frighten you." The voice took on a somewhat wry note. "You are difficult enough to manage, without additional complications."
"Well, why are we talking about it then?"
"You need to know why you have to do it. That might help you when the time comes."
"All right,"
Geryon agreed.
A very long time ago, something happened that wasn't supposed to happen. The voice in his mind began. The universe came into existence for a reason, and it was moving toward that purpose smoothly. Everything was happening the way it was supposed to happen. But then something went wrong. It wasn't really a very big thing, but it just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Or perhaps in the wrong place at the wrong time might be a better way to put it. Anyway, it changed the direction of events. Can you understand that?
I think so, Garion replied, frowning with the effort. Is it like when you throw a rock at something, but it bounces off something else instead and goes where you don't want it to go? Like the time Darun threw that rock at the crow, and it hit a tree limb, and bounced off and broke Faldor's window instead.
That's exactly it, the voice congratulated him. Up to that point, there had always been only one possibility, the original one. Now there were suddenly two. Let's take it one step further. If Durun, or you, had thrown another rock very quickly and hit the first rock before it got to Faldor's window, it's possible that the first rock might have been knocked back to hit the crow instead of the window.
Maybe, Garion conceded doubtfully. Durun wasn't really that good at throwing rocks.
I'm much better at it than Durun, the voice told him. That's the whole reason I came into existence in the first place. In a very special way, you are the rock that I have thrown. If you hit the other rock just right, you will turn it and make it go where it was originally intended to go.
And if I don't,
Faldor's window gets broken. The figure of a naked woman with her arms chopped off and a sword thrust through her body was suddenly in front of Garion. She shrieked and moaned at him, and the stumps of her arms spurted blood directly into his face. Garion reached up to wipe off the blood, but his face was dry. Unconcerned, his horse walked through the gibbering ghost.
We have to get things back on the right course, the voice went on. This certain thing you have to do is the key to the whole business. For a long time, what was supposed to happen, and what was actually happening, went off in different directions. Now they are starting to converge again. The point where they meet is the point where you will have to act. If you succeed, things will be all right again. If you don't, everything will keep going wrong, and the purpose for which the universe came into existence will fail.
How long ago was it when this started?
Before the world was made, even before the gods.
Will I succeed?
I don't know. I know what's supposed to happen, not what will. There is something else you need to know, too. When this mistake occurred, it set off two separate lines of possibility, and a line of possibility has a kind of purpose. To have a purpose, there has to be awareness of that purpose. To put it rather simply, that's what I am. The awareness of the original purpose of the universe.
Only now there's another one too, isn't there? Another awareness, I mean? One connected with the other set of possibilities.
Why, you're even brighter than I thought.
And wouldn't it want to keep things going the wrong way?
I'm afraid so. Now we come to the important part. The spot in time where all of this is going to be decided one way or another. It's getting very close. And you have got to be ready.
Why me?
Garion asked, brushing away a disconnected hand that appeared to be trying to clutch at his throat.
Can't somebody else do it?
No, the voice told him. That's not the way it works. The universe has been waiting for you for millions of years, more than you could even imagine. You have been hurtling toward this event since before the beginning of time.
it is yours alone. You are the only one who can do what needs to be done, and it's the most important thing that will ever happen, not just in this world, but in all of the worlds, in all of the universe. There are whole races of men on worlds so far away that the light from their suns will never reach this world, and they will cease to exist if you fail. They will never know you, nor thank you, but their entire existence depends on you. The other line of possibility leads to absolute chaos and the ultimate destruction of the universe, but you and I lead to something else. What? If you are successful, you will live to see it happen. All right. What do I have to do? Now, I mean. You have enormous power. It has been given to you so that you can do what you have to do. But you have got to learn how to use it. Belgareth and Thalgara are trying to help you learn, so stop fighting with them about it. You've got to be ready when the time comes, and the time is much closer than you might think.
A decapitated figure stood in the trail, holding its head by the hair with its right hand. As Geryon approached, the figure raised the head. The twisted mouth shrieked curses at him. After he had ridden through the ghost, Geryon tried to speak to the mind within his mind again, but it seemed to be gone for the moment. They rode slowly past the tumbled stones of a ruined farmstead. Ghosts clustered thickly on the stones, beckoning and calling seductively.
A disproportionate number seem to be women, Aunt Paul observed calmly to Mr. Wolf.
It was a peculiarity of the race, Wolf replied. 8 out of 9 births were female. It made certain adjustments necessary in the customary relationships between men and women.
I imagine you found that entertaining, she said dryly.
The Murags didn't look at things precisely the way other races do. Marriage never gained much status among them. They were quite liberal about certain things.
Oh, is that the term for it?
Try not to be so narrow-minded, Paul. The society functioned. That's what counts.
There is a bit more to it than that, Father. What about their cannibalism?
That was a mistake. Somebody misinterpreted a passage in one of their sacred texts, that's all. They did it out of a sense of religious obligation, not out of appetite. On the whole, I rather liked the Murags. They were generous, friendly, very honest with each other. They enjoyed life. If it had not been for the gold here, they'd probably have worked out their little aberration.
Geryon had forgotten about the gold. As they crossed a small stream, he looked down into the sparkling water and saw the butter-yellow flecks glittering among the pebbles on the bottom. A naked ghost suddenly appeared before him.
"Don't you think I'm beautiful?"
she leered. Then she took hold of the sides of the great slash that ran up her abdomen, pulled it open, and spilled out her entrails in a pile on the bank of the stream. Geryon gagged and clenched his teeth together.
"Don't think about the gold," the voice in his mind said. The ghosts come at you through your greed. If you think about the gold, you will go mad.
They rode on, and Geryon tried to push the thought of gold out of his mind. Mr. Wolf, however, continued to talk about it.
That's always been the problem with gold. It seems to attract the worst kind of people. The Tonedrans, in this case.
They were trying to stamp out cannibalism, Father. That's a custom most people find repugnant.
I wonder how serious they'd have been about it if all of that gold hadn't been lying on the bed of every stream in Maragor.
Aunt Paul averted her eyes from the ghost of a child impaled on a Tonedran spear.
And now no one has the gold. Mara saw to that.
Yes,
Wolf agreed, lifting his face to listen to the dreadful wail that seemed to come from everywhere. He winced at a particularly shrill note in the wailing.
I wish he wouldn't scream so loud.
They passed the ruins of what appeared to have been a temple. The white stones were tumbled and grass grew up among them. A broad tree standing nearby was festooned with hanging bodies, twisting and swinging on their ropes.
Let us down,
the bodies murmured.
Let us down.
Father, Aunt Paul said sharply, pointing at the meadow beyond the fallen temple.
Over there. Those people are real.
A procession of robed and hooded figures moved slowly through the meadow, chanting in unison to the sound of a mournfully tolling bell supported on a heavy pole that they carried on their shoulders.
The monks of Ma Teren, Wolf said. Tonedra's conscience. They aren't anything to worry about.
One of the hooded figures looked up and saw them.
Go back, he shouted.
He broke away from the others and ran toward them, recoiling often from things Geryon could not see.
Go back, he cried again. Save yourselves.
You approach the very center of this horror. Mar Aemon lies just beyond that hill. Mara himself rages through its haunted streets.
Chapter 6 The procession of monks moved on, the sound of their chanting and slowly tolling bell growing fainter as they crossed the meadow. Mr. Wolf seemed deep in thought, the fingers of his good hand stroking his beard. Finally, he sighed, rather wryly.
I suppose we might as well deal with him here and now, Paul. He'll just follow us if we don't.
You're wasting your time, Father,
Aunt Paul replied.
There is no way to reason with him. We've tried that before.
You're probably right. But we should try, at least. Aljor would be disappointed if we didn't. Maybe when he finds out what's happening, he will come around to the point where we can at least talk to him.
A piercing wail echoed across the sunny meadow, and Mr. Wolf made a sour face.
You'd think that he'd have shrieked himself out by now. All right, let's go to Mar Aemon.
He turned his horse toward the hill the wild-eyed monk had pointed out to them. A maimed ghost gibbered at him from the air in front of his face.
Oh, stop that, he said irritably.
With a startled flicker, the ghost disappeared. There had, perhaps, been a road leading over the hill at some time in the past. The faint track of it was dimly visible through the grass. But the 32 centuries which had passed since the last living foot had touched its surface had all but erased it. They wound to the top of the hill and looked down into the ruins of Mar Aemon. Geryon, still detached and unmoved, perceived and deduced things about the city he would not have otherwise noted. Though the destruction had been nearly total, the shape of the city was clearly evident. The street, for there was only one, was laid out in a spiral winding in toward a broad circular plaza in the precise center of the ruins. With a peculiar flash of insight, Geryon became immediately convinced that the city had been designed by a woman. Men's minds ran to straight lines, but women thought more in terms of circles. With Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolf in the lead, and the rest following in a wooden-faced unconsciousness, they started down the hill to the city. Geryon rode at the rear, trying to ignore the ghosts rising from the earth to confront him with their nudity and their hideous maiming. The wailing sound, which they had heard from the moment they had entered Meragor, grew louder and more distinct. The wail had sometimes seemed to be a chorus, confused and distorted by echoes. But now, Geryon realized, it was one single mighty voice, filled with a grief so vast that it reverberated through all of the kingdom. As they approached the city, a terrible wind seemed to come up, deadly chill, and filled with an overpowering charnel-house stench. As Geryon reached automatically to draw his cloak tighter about him, he saw that the cloak did not in any way react to the wind, nor did the tall grass through which they rode bend before it. He considered it. If the wind did not move the grass, it could not be a real wind. Furthermore, if the horses could not hear the wails, they could not be real wailing either. He grew colder and shivered, even as he told himself that the chill, like the wind and the grief-laden howling, was spiritual rather than real. Although Mar-Amon, when he had first glimpsed it from the top of the hill, had appeared to be in total ruin, when they entered the city, Geryon was startled to see the substantial walls of houses and public buildings surrounding him. And somewhere, not far away, he seemed to hear the sound of laughing children. There was also the sound of singing off in the distance.
"Why does he keep doing this?" Aunt Paul asked sadly. "It doesn't do any good."
"It's all he has, Paul," Mr. Wolfe replied.
"It always ends the same, though."
"I know. But for a little while it helps him to forget."
"There are things we would all like to forget, Father. This is not the way to do it."
Wolfe looked admiringly at the substantial seeming houses around them.
"It is very good, you know."
"Naturally. He is a god, after all. But it's still not good for him."
It was not until Barak's horse inadvertently stepped directly through one of the walls, disappearing through the solid-looking stone and then re-emerging several yards farther down the street, that Geryon understood what his aunt and grandfather were talking about. The walls, the buildings, the whole city was an illusion, a memory. The chill wind with its stink of corruption seemed to grow stronger and carried with it now the added reek of smoke. Though Geryon could still see the sunlight shining brightly on the grass, it seemed for some reason that it was growing noticeably darker. The laughter of the children and the distant singing faded. Geryon heard screams. A Tolnedran legionnaire, in burnished breastplate and plumed helmet, as solid-looking as the walls around them, came running down the long curve of the street. His sword dripped blood, his face was fixed in a hideous grin, and his eyes were wild. Hacked and mutilated bodies sprawled in the street now, and there was blood everywhere. The wailing climbed into a piercing shriek as the illusion moved on toward its dreadful climax. The spiral street opened at last into the broad circular plaza at the center of Mar-Amon. The icy wind seemed to howl through the burning city, and the dreadful sounds of swords chopping through flesh and bone seemed to fill Geryon's entire mind. The air grew even darker. The stones of the plaza were thick with the illusory memory of uncounted scores of Marag dead lying beneath rolling clouds of dense smoke. But what stood in the center of the plaza was not an illusion nor even a ghost. The figure towered and seemed to shimmer with a terrible presence, a reality that was in no way dependent upon the mind of the observer for its existence. In its arms, it held the body of a slaughtered child that seemed somehow to be the sum and total of all of the dead of haunted Maragor, and its face, lifted in anguish above the body of that dead child, was ravaged by an expression of inhuman grief. The figure wailed, and Geryon, even in the half-somnolent state that protected his sanity, felt the hair on the back of his neck trying to rise in horror.